Hey everybody, this is Josh Wood. I'm the host of Let the Adventure Begin, expatexchange.com's podcast about moving, living, and traveling abroad. Today we're lucky enough to have an interview with a very good friend of mine. Patrick lived in Japan for 17 years. He left for Tokyo a bachelor in his late 20s and returned to the United States married to a beautiful Japanese woman and the father of two sons. So as you can imagine, Patrick has a whole lot to share about living abroad. So without further ado, welcome to Let the Adventure Begin, Patrick. How are you today?
Good. Thanks for having me, Josh.
So why don't we just get the ball rolling real quickly with you talking a little bit about how your expat assignment came to fruition.
The way my expat assignment initially came up was the guy who ran a similar function as mine in Japan. He was losing one of his managers very quickly. She was going to move to the U.S., ironically, and so he needed to replace her, couldn't find anybody. He asked my boss in the U.S. if he could borrow somebody until he found a replacement, and so we eventually agreed on, you know, I would go to Japan. I would recruit and hire somebody for the position. I would train them, get them up and running, and then I would go back to the U.S. And at the time, you know, I was pretty, my boss was asking, you know, do you want to go for a year? Do you want to go for 2 years? I was pretty comfortable with my life in New Jersey. I had, you know, a girlfriend living in the city. I was living in the countryside in New Jersey, about an hour outside of New York City. I had a dog. I had, you know, a life. So I was single. I was about 27 years old when this all came up. But I had a pretty comfortable rhythm, I would say, in my lifestyle and my work patterns. So when it came up, I was thinking more of a shorter term. And I suggested, well, why don't I do it for 3 months? Or we finally agreed, why don't you do it for 6 months? That would be enough time probably to find somebody, hire them, get them on board, and, you know, be with them for 2 to 3 months to train them. So I went in already kind of putting a much more limited term than the usual 2 to 3 year expat assignment that our company was used to setting up.
So you end up in Tokyo. What was it like adjusting there? What was it like, you know, everyday life in Tokyo at first? And but as you were mm-hmm. saying, you grew up around New York City and you were familiar with that. Did that help at all?
Yeah.
You know, the urban experience that you were so used to?
Well, I had another, you know, and maybe it was good to set me up for the rest of my years in Japan. I had another humbling experience when I first arrived in Tokyo. So I was working on this big project in Singapore, I mentioned. One of the customers was based in Japan. And so I actually flew directly from Singapore to Tokyo for the first time ever going to Japan. The main purpose was to deliver this proposal, a response to an RFP, along with a Japanese sales guy. You know, we had a couple of official copies of the document. I actually had one as my carry-on bag. So, you know, I had it with me on my body on the flight. And we arrive at Narita Airport in Tokyo. And I found that the sales guy who was on the same flight with me, he arranged for a truck, for someone else from the office to come with a rented truck to carry all the boxes of the proposal back to the office. But either intentionally or unintentionally, the truck only had two seats, one for him and one for his friend. And he kind of looked at me after he took the one that I had carried on the plane and said, okay, well, there's a bus somewhere over there and I'll see you at the office tomorrow morning.
Oh, geez.
So, I found, you know, this airport limousine bus, like a shuttle bus that goes from Narita Airport, which is about an hour outside of Tokyo, to get into Tokyo. So, you know, looking back, and I think I was going to give advice to other folks thinking about or planning on starting an assignment, I'm pretty happy that I was lost initially. You know, I had a lot of folks from the office offering to take me out, and they were really hospitable. The first time I walked in the office, who would become my Japan manager, he immediately said, well, why don't you just stay for 2 years? That was, like, I think the first thing he said to me. And I kind of smiled. I was like, laughed. I'm like, nah, I got to get back. I have a life back in the U.S. But you know, he was very welcoming. Everybody there was, you know, very welcoming, happy to see, you know, somebody new. But I also took, you know, I took time to get lost myself. So I kind of stumbled around a bit. I found a lot of side alleys and things. And if for anyone who's been to Tokyo, it's It's a labyrinth of, medieval side streets and things like that. It's not a Manhattan crisscross design where everything's logically numbered. There's no street names. There's no, or there's very few street names. There's a archaic numbering system from when it was more of a feudal type city. And so it's very easy to get lost, but that was also exciting because I can remember like stumbling into a sushi bar by myself and sitting at the bar for the first time and not being able to speak or read anything. And it wasn't a touristy place. And I just smiled at the chef and said, kind of whatever you recommend. And he gave me some. It wasn't anything like California roll or anything, most Americans would be used to. It was some things I didn't recognize. And I think he intentionally tried to challenge me. Like he gave me a big chunk of octopus. And then he just kind of he stood in front of me, expressionless, and watched to wait me eat it all. And I put it in my mouth, and I think I don't know, like I still feel he intentionally did it as a test because it was octopus is great for anybody who's had, fresh raw octopus. It's really good. If it's not so fresh or if it's boiled too much, it gets like very rubbery. And I think he must have boiled it or something, or he gave me a really rubbery hard piece, and I was chewing on that thing for about 30 minutes while he stood and stared at me. So that was yeah, I think getting lost was very good. And then trying to find my bearings. I did try to learn a little bit of language on that flight from Singapore to Tokyo. It's about a, I think it was like a 6 or 7 hour flight. This was before smartphones and things like that, but I had a little guide pamphlet or something. And I learned how to introduce myself formally in Japanese because I heard that was very important. So say yoroshiku onegaishimasu or hajimemashite, say my name. So I knew how to introduce myself. I knew how to say yes because, hi, hi. That's, I think some people hear that from movies or things. So I recognized that one. But I didn't know how to say no. I didn't know the word for Japanese. The Japanese word for no is ie, is one way to say it. So, I think the reason people were so hospitable to me was, I could formally introduce myself in Japanese and I didn't know how to say no. So they thought I was very, pleasant, polite, and agreeable to anything. And they'd just ask me anything and I'd say, hi, hi. Or I'd just nod my head, not to show that I understood what they were saying, but just to, I'm listening to you. I know you're saying words, and they kind of believed that I understood Japanese.
Yeah, you said that offline that for whatever reason they thought you were fluent, and that kind of worked for you though, didn't it? It kind of made things kind of grease the wheels for a little while.
A little bit. I mean, just I guess, and I don't mean to. I have a different style, so the other bit of advice is just to listen a little bit. So I was just content on listening to folks, and they would continue to speak in Japanese in front of me, thinking that I understood or have a conversation with somebody else Japanese there. And that did kind of grease the wheels a bit because it brought me into the conversation more. It brought me into the circle. Either they thought I could understand it or they thought I couldn't understand it at all. So who cares? Let's just talk in front of him. They could have been talking about me for all I know, but no, they wouldn't do that. So it was so it did help to kind of bring me into the circle kind of as much as you can in Japan initially. And I used to go out with some people would switch to English if there was one English speaker in the group and we were out at for lunch or whatever as a work group, everybody would switch to English just to make it more equitable. And some folks they would just continue on in Japanese the whole way, and I would just sit and listen. And I think that just listening helped build up a kind of recognition later when I did start, studying Japanese. It helped a lot to have a recognition, to have that basis.
Yeah. So at what point did you formally, start to really train to learn the language, and how did that all play out?
Yeah, so they right when I got there, they told me they would offer the company would sponsor some language training. And our company had, two schools that they used. But luckily, in hindsight, I talked to, let's say, younger people in the office to find out what their experience was. because we had probably, out of all the people we had a pretty big office in Tokyo, and maybe 10% of the office was foreigners or expats. So big Japanese base in the in office, but I knew all the expats basically, or most of them, and could ask them what their experience was. But then
Okay.
I talked with one colleague, this young Dutch engineer. He told me, no, you have to use my school. It's not one of the standard or official schools that the company uses, but I'm using it, and they cover the expenses and everything. And that school, for me, I was really so lucky that he suggested it, because their approach seems, quite logical in hindsight again, but their approach was basically you build a skeleton of the language, and then you add muscles and meat to the bones later. And that skeleton is really, you learn the grammar first. So forget about vocabulary. You're going to learn the grammar, and you can do it in English. And I'll give you an example. You can do it in English. And then as you pick up vocabulary, which is just natural as you're there longer and study more, you'll add the vocabulary and switch out the English for Japanese, and build it that way. So, the example that they used at the school was, if I wanted to say, I would say in English, the cat chases the mouse. In Japanese, I would just say, cat wa mouso chase shimasu. So that's a proper Japanese statement, but I just had to put in the right grammar cues and put it in the right order. And I can still
Okay.
use the English words. And then if I said that with a Japanese accent, like kato wa mouso chase shimasu, that's still English. It's still not proper Japanese, but 99% of Japanese people would understand what I meant when I said it that way.
Okay.
So once I had, it was, for me, it was almost mathematical that way. Once I had the formula or the code, the grammar, I mean, almost immediately it was a kind of level up experience, because then I went to a meeting and I still didn't know what the folks were talking about in Japanese, but I knew, well, these two guys are talking about that customer, and it's about it's something, and it's this word. And then I could just figure out what that word was, or ask somebody, and then I knew, okay, it was immediately the comprehension level went up. And then and I'm simplifying it a bit, but just having that level of, the basic formula for grammar, helped tremendously to put things in context. And for me, in Japanese anyway, a lot of it was contextual learning, because, especially if you're in a work environment, you kind of know the subject area, who's talking. So if the company lawyer comes and he's talking to a sales guy, they're probably talking about
Right.
a contract. And so you
Yep.
can kind of contextualize and figure out, well, this must be some legal vocabulary that I don't know, but I can figure out. And it got to the point that, contextualization of Japanese got to the point where people would bring me contracts in Japanese and ask me to approve it and ask me to read through it. And this is like months after I got there. And it got to the point where, I kept seeing them so often. So let's say it was from customer A. I kept seeing they had a standard boilerplate contract. I kept seeing it so often that eventually it was almost like the Matrix. If I noticed that one thing was different, I could zero in on that and say, oh, but what is this? And they would be
Right.
surprised, and then, oh yeah, they want to change the payment terms or something. How did you know that? I'm like, I don't know, but
That's different. That's not what's in there usually.
exactly. I think we learned that in
Yeah.
Sesame Street, which one of these doesn't belong. So just like listening, that helped, because I wasn't trying to trick anybody, but I was just trying to dive in a little bit and get help from a lot of people in filling in the vocabulary.
So shopping in Japan. Did you kind of go out of your way at first to find familiar foods and that sort of thing, or did you try to immerse yourself in the Japanese experience? Did you have the option or?
I'm not too conservative of an eater, so I was happy to try different things. And, especially if someone took me somewhere, I was always willing to, be a good guest and trust them to try something. I did know people who were there for a while. Like one guy, he ate every meal at the TGI Fridays that was in Tokyo. I couldn't understand why, but there was one like walking distance from the office, and he always went there. I was familiar with sushi. I was probably familiar with a couple of Japanese cuisines, but not all of them. And I was pretty surprised at the variety. of just Japanese cuisines. Like we see some limited amount in the US anyway. We know sushi, we know ramen is popular now, like noodles,
Right.
and there are so many other different cuisines that I was just really surprised and enjoyed. Like, you know, breaded pork cutlets is a big thing, tonkatsu, it's called, which sounds like something an American would do. Let's cut some pork and dip it in a deep fryer and everything, but it's quite common there. So just, I mean, there were so many different kinds. Most of the people from the office went out for lunch, and we were in the center of Tokyo, so I had a good chance to experience a lot of different cuisines just there. And then probably even, I shouldn't have been in hindsight, but more surprising was the quality and the taste of non-Japanese foods in Tokyo. Pretty much every I could find everything except there was only like one good Mexican restaurant at the time, but you could find almost any. It's an international city, even though it's mostly Japanese,
Right.
but they have a very good, I would say, characteristic that if a Japanese wanted to learn about French cuisine, they would go study in Paris and work at a restaurant in Paris and really study the technique down to the way you hold the blade and everything else with the knife, and they would study it, and then they would bring it back to Tokyo and replicate it, like set up the same
Yep.
kitchen, everything else. And the only big difference was that the quality and freshness of the food in Japan was sometimes better than what you could find in the country where the cuisine originated from. So I had a lot of French colleagues who would always tell me, we'd go to French restaurants and they would say, oh, they would just be like making food, yummy food noises the whole time. Like, this is even better than in Paris. And the service isn't rude and everything else. So, like, they were slamming their own country because they couldn't believe that, you know, Japanese had taken their pride, their cuisine, and actually brought it up a level. So I was also like just surprised because I thought, you know, living close to New York and trying a lot of different Italian foods and things like that, that we had a, you know, really high quality and high level of cuisine, but the international food there was really amazing.
Okay, so we've touched on food a bit, but when I think of Japan, and unfortunately I've never been, but and am dying to go. But one of the things I think about is the sushi, and that's one of the things I would really want to dive into and experience. So there's got to be so many different varieties and types that we would just not even would never have experienced here. And some of the stuff that you loved, what are some of the are there exotic things that were even kind of like a bridge too far for you that you wouldn't try? You're willing to put yourself out there, I know, and try a lot of different things, but were there some things that were just too much?
Well, I'll start with the last question first. I mean, fish sperm was one that was like fish ejaculate, basically. That was something that got served, and I think even my wife handed hers to me and said, I'm not used to having that in my mouth. So that was one that I ate it, but it was, you know, it's one of the ones you put in your mouth and you know, try not to think about till it's in your stomach. So that was one, but that's not typical, I'll say. And that was at a really nice place. So sometimes they try to screw you by saying they're nice.
Obviously.
Yes, obviously. Look, like similar to what I said before, like the good thing is the quality is typically good. So when I say quality, the freshness of the fish, the preparation of it, the care and the attention that the staff puts into preparing it and the presentation, whether you're going to a really cheap place, a really expensive place, it tends it's safe and it's good. So with having said that, then it comes down to preference. So you know, you could spend a lot and go to like one of the famous like Jiro's place, like Jiro Dreams of Sushi. His restaurant is one of the top rated ones in Tokyo, partly because of the film, but you could spend you know, a couple hundred dollars easily for one person to go to a place like that. But you know, my recommendation, that's a great once in a lifetime, or I don't know how wealthy you are, 5 times in a lifetime experience. But
Right.
you don't need to do that as my recommendation. You can have, you know, you can find quality sushi even at, you know, small neighborhoods. And even at, relatively cheap, like family restaurants. People are familiar now with conveyor belt sushi restaurants, and I think they even have some in the US and in Europe. But that's pretty typical and usually not too expensive, but that's where, they prepare a lot of standard items and put them on a plate, and it goes around a conveyor belt around the counter or around the restaurant, and you can just grab what you like, what plate you like, or you can order things. And then the plates have, typically they're a different color plate, means it's a different price. And so you, like, if you want tuna, you'll take that and you'll eat it and you'll keep the plate. When the waitress comes, so they used to, when it was analog, they would count up the plates you have, like, oh, there's five red plates and three blue ones, so this is your bill. Now, of course, they have hidden QR codes and stuff in the plate, so they scan it with their a device and they know how much you have to pay. But something like that's fun, especially for kids. They like, if kids like trains and stuff, they like things coming on a conveyor belt.
Keep the kids entertained while you're out for
Kids
dinner, right?
entertained. Yeah, they love it. And then and there's so many, I couldn't recommend one sushi place, but what I could say is, there's some typical experiences for tourists or for expats. There used to be a famous fish market in Japan called Tsukiji, Tsukiji in English, which was the traditional fish market for centuries. And so it was a working fish market, one of the largest in the world in terms of volume of seafood that went through, that goes through it every day. But that would be operational from usually from, I think, two around 1 or 2 in the morning till about, 10 in the morning, with the biggest activity around 5, 6 in the morning, because they bring the fish in, and then it's like a wholesale fish market. So you have shops or distributors coming in, negotiating with the fish companies, and then taking it out.
They come in and they bid and everything on
Yeah.
the fish, right?
They would bid on the tuna. That's a famous thing. And so it became a popular tourist destination because it's absolute chaos. It's like, I've compared it to going to a zoo, but then you eat the zebra afterwards, because you'll see, seafoods, everything else that you probably have never even, you don't know what it is. And it's just managed chaos, because everybody who works there knows what they're doing. There's little tiny aisles that you can walk through, but then they have like these driving devices that are zipping around to transport stuff. I mentioned that because that was also a popular place to go for the freshest sushi that you could have. So they have a bunch of restaurants that evolved around that, because the people who work there need to eat too. So restaurants popped up in the fish market, and that was some of the best sushi. So you could go there for breakfast early in the morning or after a late night. Just head to the fish market, and there's really, really tiny places, but it's the freshest fish in the world, pretty
And
much, unless you're
that's
on a
hard
boat.
for like some people coming from other parts of the world. Like in Japan,
Yeah.
fish will be part of just about every meal, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's some did that take you a while to get used to, or is that something you just kind of dove in and
So I didn't eat a lot of sushi growing up. I think my first sushi experience, a proper sushi experience, was maybe I was like 16 at a restaurant in Manhattan.
Remember the meetup we went to?
Yeah,
Is that
exactly. Yeah, that's it. And there
This
was a
is
big.
just for people that are listening. As I said, Patrick and I are good friends, and one of our friends' fathers took us to, I think, probably a Rangers game and then to the meetup or something like that,
Well,
or
no, it was, we went in and met him for, we just wanted to meet him at his office, and he was going out to lunch with his buddy. And so they took us, a bunch of, high school kids, and it was to a really great place near Wall Street, Mita. I wasn't prepared for the wasabi, I think.
Yes, I remember that.
Yeah, and I couldn't finish it, so I took it out of my mouth trying to be polite, and I put it in a napkin, and I balled it up, and I hid it behind like a little something that was on the table, whether like a flower vase or something else. And when the waitress came over to clear our plates, she found it near me and she looked at me. She said, and like she teased me that I didn't finish it and made a big point of it. But
And one last aside, I don't know if you remember the one appetizer they had there called, it was beef negamaki.
beef
I, is
negamaki. I
what
don't remember.
is that's what they called it, and it incorporated beef and cheese, and it's the only time I've ever had that. It was delicious, whether it was authentic or not.
Oh
It
yeah.
was incredible, and I think scallions were in there as well. But
Scallions, yeah. If negi is Japanese for like scallions, so and
okay.
negamaki is it was beef and scallions on like a rice ball, basically, I think.
Yep.
Probably.
Okay, but we digress. So, yeah.
No, but it's a good, painful, embarrassing memory for me.
Right.
So that Tsukiji market was traditionally also a fun tourist place for folks to go, and not people wouldn't go there every day. It's not like a normal everyday thing that people do, but you go there as a tourist or as an expat, you could go there. But you could also buy fish as an individual there. So we've gone there and bought, we bought lobsters, we bought fish. If you become friendly with a shop owner, they've moved the wholesale market to a different location as part of the whole Tokyo Olympics
Okay.
cleanup, and just because the market was kind of run down, they wanted to put it in a more efficient area. But there are still restaurants, sushi restaurants there, and there's still what they call the outside market, which was outside of the wholesale area, and that's still great for tourists or for expats alike to go and visit and see a lot of you can get a lot of ingredients, and there's really good sushi restaurants, because just because for centuries that's where the fish market was.
Right.
So anywhere near there, heading even over to like famous areas like Ginza, any of the sushi restaurants in there are typically, you can find really good ones. But my favorite thing was to find a neighborhood spot where I went
Yep.
enough that the people knew me and my family, and we were really welcome there. So there's all those neighborhood spots sprinkled around. They're not famous, but if you find a good one, it's like finding a good neighborhood bar or restaurant, whatever, cafe.
Yep.
You're kind of welcome there, and it's tiny, but the quality's good. And then I talked about it in terms of my first sushi experience in Tokyo when I was by myself. But what's really nice is you do the omakase course, which is basically you don't order the things yourself. You just let the chef prepare, what's the freshest or best fish or
Yeah.
items that he has that day, and they'll prepare a course for you, and you just, he puts stuff out if you're sitting at the counter, and you might ask, what is this? Or you might explain. And that's really great because the chef is the person who knows the most about the quality of the fish and what's
Right.
good for that day. And you get to explore a little bit and try new things.
So if you had to pick your favorite type of fish over there, is it just tuna or were
Well,
there?
yeah, I mean, tuna is the most popular sushi. The tuna roll is the most popular in Tokyo. They're not really big on things like California roll or some of the hybrid or fusion type sushis that became popular in the US. So it's more traditional sashimi, which will be just like the raw fish on that you can have. But tuna, I mean, tuna is the most popular because it's probably the easiest to eat, but then there's different grades of tuna. So you can have the otoro, which is the most marbleized, and it melts like butter in your mouth. That one is, I would have some time during my course as a treat, and you can see everybody's face where they're just like, oh, making like the melting face, because it does kind of melt into your mouth, which you don't typically think of fish as doing. So I like that. And then any kind of varieties, like that you could go and get a you could order a course just, focused on tuna, but within that you'd have, six different sushis or sashimis with different grades of tuna, prepared with scallions or with a little bit of ginger root on it and things like that.
And the and when people think of sushi here, it's wasabi and ginger, the pickled ginger that comes with it, but that's they're different in Japan than you would get them here in the United States, aren't they?
Well, yeah, wasabi in the US is mostly horseradish,
Right.
because importing wasabi and keeping it fresh is really difficult. And so the only place where they make traditional wasabi is roots, is an area called Shizuoka, which is south of Tokyo, a couple, about 2 hours south of Tokyo. And it's because it has the mountain water running down from the Mount Fuji, and you have to plant it
Right.
a certain way. It's a very delicate plant. I've always said, well, why don't we just grow it here? We have streams and stuff and fresh
Right.
water. And recently, especially in places like Oregon, the Northwest and Pacific Northwest, and even in New York State, they have found ways to grow proper wasabi.
I've seen that. I've seen that.
Right.
Yes. Yep.
I'm interested in growing some myself, but yeah, it's different because it's not as it doesn't slap you in the face. It's more subtle, the taste. So, even in Japan, you'll have different things that are less or more authentic. But typically, yeah, you don't have the horseradish wasabi that you have
Right.
here.
So when you were there, did you do a lot of business travel that like from Tokyo to other parts of the world, or were you kind of there with that was your home base and that was where you were primarily?
So, I mean, definitely from putting aside like the personal experience, at least for me, the work experience was great because, I went over there with a specific role I was doing, and like I said, I was going to hire somebody and train them and then leave. But very quickly I found that people would bring me into meetings, partly as a comfort, because they knew I could understand what was being discussed. So if it was a call with someone from headquarters, they would bring me in because I could tell them the nuances and the body language of the person on the video call or whatever, and explain to them what was going on. So I got pulled into a lot of different work situations where I really didn't belong. And that kind of expanded my role wider and wider to, all areas of the business. Eventually, in the 17 years, I did, everything from, dealing with customers, dealing with IT, dealing with real estate, dealing with supply chain, dealing with finance, do all kinds of things simply because of that experience. And because of that, that expanded my role beyond Japan. So eventually, I was doing like an Asia Pacific and China role from Tokyo. And so I did have the opportunity to make a lot of business trips around Asia from Tokyo. And Tokyo is pretty, it's a big travel hub in Tokyo from an airport perspective. It's not as centrally located as somewhere like Singapore for Asia. So Singapore, the big thing is, you can go anywhere. Singapore itself, it takes like, I don't know, 30 minutes to get across by taxi, but you can easily go anywhere from Singapore. Tokyo was pretty good in that regard, especially for work. So I had a lot of business trips all through Asia. A lot of times to Shanghai, to Seoul, Korea, a lot of times to Singapore, to Hong Kong, to where else? To Kuala Lumpur again, to Cambodia, to Australia. For leisure travel, we would go on trips, and it was easy. You could fly directly to Thailand, and it wasn't a long flight. You could fly direct flights to. We spent, the Y2K thing was coming, and so my wife and I said, "Well, where do we want to be if everything goes crazy?" And we found there was a direct flight to Fiji, and we went to a little island. Fiji has a lot of islands, and so we had a direct flight from Tokyo to Fiji, and then we took a boat to this little island, and we were there for New Year's Eve for Y2K. We did our honeymoon in Tahiti because that was a direct flight from Tokyo. It wasn't that long, so there were a lot more. It was a different perspective on where we could go, especially if we started looking east from Japan and looking into the Pacific Ocean. There was a lot of little islands that we went to Guam, we went to Fiji, we went to Tahiti. We had plans to go to New Caledonia, that we didn't go, but it's definitely easy to get outside of Japan. And then even within Japan, that was really probably the best experience because the infrastructure is so great. The train system is so efficient, so clean, so easy to use that getting around in Japan was very easy to do, like on a weekend, and, you know, relatively speaking, pretty cost efficient. So I did a lot of snowboarding when I was in Japan because they have great snow. The experience was just so hassle-free. You could pack up your gear, your skis, your snowboard, whatever, your helmet, your boots, have like the equivalent of a UPS guy come pick it up the afternoon before you were going to go. And they would deliver it to the hotel you were going to, the ski lodge, for, you know, less than $20. And then you would just take a backpack and get on the train, or if you had a flight, and you would just go right to the ski area. And some ski lodges, you know, they would even wax your stuff. They would take your boards or your skis, and they would wax it and have it set up in the lodge when you arrived. And then you just change into your gear and you go right on piece there, and you go skiing and snowboarding. It was great.
Unbelievable. Just so different, right?
Yeah. And I don't want to politicize it, but I'm just envious or nostalgic of, if I could get on like a train in even in New York City or even Secaucus or somewhere, I would, even if I had to drive there, if I could just take a high-speed rail train somewhere for the same cost, it would be so, I would go so many more places in the U.S.
Right.
By train. But so that was really efficient, and it was, I probably didn't explore Japan as much as I could or wanted to. You know, for perspective, Japan, you know, top to bottom is probably like the same length as California. Mm-hmm. Just to give you a sense of it. And I went to a lot of regions, but there's still a lot of places that I didn't go that I would have liked to have gone to. So I went to like Kyoto, of course, Osaka, the big cities, a lot of the big touristy places. But then because I was doing snowboarding, I went to a lot more small villages in what they call the Japanese Alps, and then you get in really in the woods with, you know, less people. That was nice to be in, you know, quiet, rustic Japan as well.
Okay. So Patrick, obviously having lived in Japan for 17 years in Tokyo, you got to know a lot of the city and the different neighborhoods and everything. So maybe you could talk a little bit about some of the neighborhoods that would be good for expats, and the ones that you lived in, and because obviously you can talk a little bit about how that worked for you, but then also some other areas that are desirable for people in different situations.
Most of the expats in Tokyo tend to live in central Tokyo, which is, you know, for obvious reasons, if a lot of the corporations have their offices mostly in center Tokyo, people are trying to consider having a shorter commute, an easier commute. So just like any city, you'd want to think about where am I going to be spending my time, and how do I want to limit my distance and my time spent getting there? So a lot of people will center, you know, their home searches close to the offices. And then they'll also, if they're going with a family, they'll consider schools. And then the other consideration, obviously, is how are you going to spend your leisure time? Tokyo, you could, you know, people do spend years just living a life of leisure within Tokyo, but then you have a lot of easy options with transportation to get outside of the city, really to get in nature, to do, you know, we talked about skiing or snowboarding or, you know, hiking, whatever. So being near either a transportation hub or more in, you know, the outside of the city, will help you do that. So, you know, for those who aren't familiar, you know, Tokyo is on the water. It has a big bay. And it's also in kind of the foothills of the mountains that lead up to Mount Fuji. So Tokyo itself, it's pretty spread out. Like we've compared it to Boston or LA in terms of having different pockets of neighborhoods for entertainment or for business. Yep. It's not like, you know, New York City or Hong Kong, which are pretty narrow and compact. And so you have more high rises, but it has those city centers or hubs spread out throughout greater Tokyo. And it's pretty hilly, not like San Francisco hilly, but again, more rolling hills throughout Tokyo. And okay. the reason I give you that basis is because, you know, Tokyo is a very ancient city. Typically a lot of the wealthier neighborhoods would be constructed on the top of a hill, which is, you know, anywhere. If you're at the top of the hill, it tends to be nicer houses. So that still exists today, where a lot of the nicer, trendier neighborhoods tended to be on top of a hill.
Better views, right?
Better views, better air, whatever. You feel better than other people below you, I guess. but that exists. That's just human nature, I guess. So,
right.
You know, just a side note, when we were looking for an apartment, we even went to the extent to look at some old maps, which showed where the banks were. Now, why would you do that? Because the banks, because of earthquakes and everything, they tried to pick locations that had the most solid ground, which were also typically on top of a hill, but the whatever the rocks were underneath, they found these were the ones that shook the least. And so we tried to find an apartment that was preferably in one of those you know, safe spots.
That's incredible. I've never heard that before.
Well, there's a I'll try to post it to you later, but there's even one time I found someone took very old maps from Tokyo and they overlaid Google Maps on top of it, so you could kind of compare through the maps through the centuries how the neighborhoods evolved, and some didn't evolve at all, but you could see what was there previously. And cool. It just helps to understand the where the names came from, everything else. But I digress. So so you want to consider, so most of the foreigners who are there, you know, for work tend to be in the center of Tokyo, which is the, you know, obviously the most expensive area, but also has the easiest access to entertainment, to, you know, tons of restaurants, there's big parks, everything like that. And a couple of neighborhoods I'll throw out, you know, that are popular for both families and individuals. There's an area called Hiro. In English, it's H-I-R-O-O.
Yep.
Which is very much in the center, you know, big expensive apartments or apartment buildings, relatively speaking. But very centrally located, and it's about, you know, halfway between the entertainment districts of Roppongi and Shibuya, and close to another popular area, Ebisu. So these names might not mean anything to you, but they're all, you know, very centrally located. If you were to look at a map, they're all Tokyo is divided into 23 wards, if you want to call them, or counties. And so the most popular ones for foreigners are really around Minato-ku. So Minato means bay in Japanese, so it's close to the water,
right?
Yep. There's Meguro-ku, which is next to that, Shibuya-ku, and a couple of others all in that area. And what we tended to find was a lot of people were in that Hiro area. There's another area called Azabu, and again, just because of convenience and proximity to some of what we call the Gaijin Ghetto. So Gaijin means foreigner. So the Gaijin Ghetto is, you know, it's not a ghetto, but it's where you find a lot of the foreigners.
I get it. I think a lot of that goes on anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
Yep.
And it's close to a place called Roppongi, I mentioned, which is a very popular entertainment district on top of a hill, actually. Which also has, you know, recently some huge tower complexes with offices and movie theaters and things like that. So, you know, you tend to, if I was to go there as an individual or family and my company set me up with a real estate agent, they have a list of areas that are popular with foreigners. So it's going to be places like Hiro, Azabu. If you're there with a family, a lot of people try to look towards an area called Yoyogi Uehara, because that's a bit more options for getting a whole house for rent as opposed to an apartment.
More space then.
A bit more space, a bit more residential. And if you're there with a family, some people they're not used to apartment living. They have the idea of having a home. So you could have a home with a postage stamp size, you know, backyard, but you would have your own entrance, perhaps a garage, and you would be the only people living there. There's more options for that as opposed to, you know, the areas I mentioned like Hiro or Azabu, which you're going to typically be an apartment, which could be anywhere from a two-story apartment building to, you know, 40 stories.
Okay. And then now, if you were a family and, you know, if you think about the best international schools that are in Japan, what would be, you know, the neighborhoods you'd be considering?
So the ones I already mentioned about Hiro and Azabu, there's a couple of international school options. There's one called Nishimachi School. Nishimachi basically means West Village in English. And okay. That's a very small private school, but that only, I think, goes K through six or through seven, maybe. So it's more of a, if you have elementary school level students. The reason why that's popular is because it's so centrally located. The other most popular foreign school is obviously the American school in Japan for Americans. That's further outside of the center of the city in an area called Denenchofu. Mm-hmm. And so that's also a popular area for folks who have, especially, you know, older kids who are going to be going to the school there. They do have buses that run from the center of Tokyo out to the school. It just depends on if, you know, how close you want to be to the school. Do you want your kids to be on a bus ride for 40 minutes or take the train? So that area is also popular because, again, you can, you're outside of the center of Tokyo, but you have a bit more space in terms of getting a house with a very tiny, tiny yard or even a bigger apartment. And you're a bit, you know, you're closer to the outskirts of center of Tokyo, so you can get outside of Tokyo a bit easier from there, especially if you have a car, which, you know, folks with families, sometimes they do choose to get a car and live it there. And, you know, not to just be, you know, U.S. focused, there's other international schools, like there's a French school and even like a French district, typically around an area called Kagurazaka, which for whatever reason, I think probably because of the school and maybe the embassy was near there, that they have more French residents. You have the British school, which is in Shibuya area, one of the popular entertainment districts. So it really depends on, you know, what language you're looking for, what country you're coming from, and again, what age the students are. It doesn't preclude you from living anywhere else. It's just, you know, again, it comes down to what kind of commute you would want to do for work versus what commute you want your kids to do. As an example, for folks who lived in center of Tokyo but sent their kids out to the American school, sometimes the if the mom wasn't working, she would drive the kids out there and just hang out there during the school day with other moms.
Yep.
Which is okay, but you don't want to do it every day, perhaps.
Right. Yeah, and it's everyone's got to prioritize what's most important to them and make a decision. I mean, you certainly hear about how, you know, if there's more than one international school that parents are interested in, they'll opt for the one that's closest to the husband's or wife's job, whoever's working, and then they'll look for a house around there. But, you know, it's good to have that in your mind at the beginning of the process as opposed to later. Any other thoughts about neighborhoods? Because I also wanted to talk. Okay, go ahead.
Well, we talked before about maybe it's not just families, but even if you're an individual, and what kind of focus you want. So all the areas I mentioned, those are still, like, I went there as a single guy. Those were all really good too, because they were centrally located. They're close to places you want to go out or have fun. But a lot of young people would even choose to be in neighborhoods that were a bit further outside of the center of Tokyo, but had a lot more options for, I don't want to call it artsy craftsy, but it's a bit more clubby, a bit more affordable. So traditionally, there was an area called Shimokitazawa, which is really, again, it's close to Shinjuku, which is a big city area. But it's just a little bit further, and that had it would almost be like, if I compared it to Manhattan, it was like an East Village. It had I don't know what to call it, a dirtier but fun
seedier or something,
a little bit seedier, but it's changed a lot over the past 30 years. But traditionally it was more for, like, college students would go there to play at a bar with their band or whatever.
Okay.
To give it a feel. And then there's another
area.
That
sounds great.
Called,
that sounds awesome. That,
it was always popular and, you know, for going out. And then there's another area called Kichijoji, which is, again, just slightly further from the center. But it just seemed to have more trees, more cafes, and more events just for people in the neighborhood. So that was also a popular area for single people who maybe couldn't afford to be in the center of Tokyo.
Right.
And a lot more areas with, you know, there's still not as much teleworking in Tokyo than what you would see in, you know, the US as a comparison. But you do find the neighborhood where people can live is changing a lot with that, even in Tokyo. And so some of the areas I listed were, you know, what traditionally people were, where they would go if they were an expat, but that's changing a lot. A lot of people, you know, they'll try to be the pioneer who lives in a neighborhood where there's zero expats, and they're the foreigner that walks down the street, and the old man who's sweeping the street kind of, he growls at you for the first, you know, two years, and then after a while he slowly like smiles at you.
Right.
So there's lots of that, and I would say expats going to Tokyo are much more prepared you know, for the experience, like, you know, through suggestions you've made. So
right.
So I think they're more I would say ambitious or brave to go to areas that aren't that popular.
Well, and regardless of where expats are moving to, we've noticed this for years on Expat Exchange that different people have a different attitude about it going into the whole process, where some people don't want a thing to do with another expat. They're going to be, you know, they want to be like Marco Polo going like, you know, and that doesn't just mean Asia. But then you have other people that are like, yeah, you know, it's just going to be easier, and I think I'll have more fun if I just settle in with expats, and then I can kind of branch out from there.
Yeah, so, exactly. So, and like you start thinking about food options or even language options. So those areas that were traditional for expats, the benefit is you have, you know, those supermarkets that cater to foreigners tend to be in those areas. If you know, you have to get your SpaghettiOs or whatever it is that you need, you can find it easier there. Although that's also changed with online delivery and everything. And then, what do you want in terms of your, you know, your kind of support network, whether you're going there as an individual or as a family. Sometimes it's nice to run into people with going through a similar experience, and you can, you know, trade advice, trade secrets, and, you know, form friendships over there as well.
Excellent. Thank you so much. I want to ask three questions that we're going to be posing to expats when we interview them. If you had to choose one favorite Japanese dish or meal, what would you choose?
I'm actually going to say the ramen, which is more of a comfort food. It's not very, and it's not like the cup of noodles that we would have growing up, where you just pour some hot water and some freeze-dried food. It was really, there's so many ramen shops in Japan and, you know, different regional styles and everything. But I would have to go with a comfort food like ramen, because it just doesn't compare. There's so many little local shops that have different flavors. And again, it's the quality of the food. So I can have like it's basically a cut piece of pork that's in the ramen. And that alone, you could just eat that slice of pork and that would be a full meal for you. But the way it floats on top of the noodles and everything, the presentation. So even that simple comfort food, which is very cheap and very accessible. And I'm going to go with the ramen as a favorite.
Okay, great. And then, so next, if you had to recommend one out of the way place to visit that tourists almost certainly wouldn't find their way to, what would be your recommendation for that in Japan?
Well, I have two answers. So one is actually not there anymore, but I was lucky enough to know a guy who had a friend who started a illegal bar on a boat. But just to share the experience, we knew about it, and it was not every night. And if we had some visitors, we would have to take them by taxi to an area outside of Tokyo, go through an opening in a chain link fence and go down a pier to a boat that had no lights on. And then there'd be a jazz bar inside of it. So having that kind of secret place was nice to bring visitors. But for folks, that doesn't exist anymore because it got shut down by the cops. But I would say definitely get to the mountains. So go to a Japanese onsen or hot spring. It is very touristy, but they have so many, and you can go to a small mountain with it's the kind of experience, if you're not familiar with it, you stay overnight, but you go in, you stay in the room, they bring you your meals to the room, and then you go to the hot baths at the inn. And it's just such a relaxing, 100% Japanese experience to do that. And you can find a lot of little ones that are off the beaten path and not really familiar to tourists.
Awesome. That's great. Okay. And then lastly, if you, this one might be a little tougher. If you had to pick one thing that you wish you knew before you moved to Tokyo, what do you think you wish you, what would have helped you, or what would be the one thing that would have been great to have known before you landed in Japan?
Well, I guess I kind of alluded to before. I said before, I wish I would have taken a bigger risk and just agreed to a longer assignment from the beginning, because obviously I stayed there for 17 years, so I liked it. And I knew I was going to like it going there, but I didn't know how I was going to like it. So I think limiting myself to 6 months initially led to more expat logistics and gymnastics that I had to go through with extending my contract, bit by bit and moving around. So I think if I had just, ripped the cord and signed up for like a 2+1 agreement from the beginning, probably would have been easier. I wish I would have known the implications of not doing that before going.
Right. Okay, great. Well, Patrick, thank you so much for doing this. We greatly appreciate it. So much to offer and so much great advice. So just thank you so much.
No, thanks for having me. I'm happy to talk about Japan anytime, and happy to any other time. Let me know, Josh.
Great. Thanks, Patrick.
Thanks, man.